Tonight on Arena, Thunderbolts Parthenope and The Graceless Age are among the movies up for review, and we talk to David Brophy and Gemma Negrain about a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, the opera. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can review proceedings or view proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Tonight in Arena's film reviews, Less Than Perfect Superheroes, Bella Italia, a redemptive music documentary, and The Mean Streets of Dublin. In Parthenope, which I've been practicing all day and saying it's not like Penelope, it is like Penelope, so that's why I said Penelope at the top of the programme. The master of Italian cinema, Paolo Sorrentino, brings us his love letter to the city of Naples, his own city, with a little help from Gary Oldman and pals. Documentary maker Sarah Scher brings us her latest feature, dedicated to the enigmatic Longford-based musician John Murray. And Mark O'Connor releases Amongst the Wolves, a gritty story of drugs and violence set in our capital city. With me in studio, Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington, who have been to the cinema. And we'll start with the blockbuster release of the week, which comes from Marvel, stars former Arena guests Florence Pugh and Sebastian Stan, and also the wonderful Julie Louis-Dreyfus. Ruth, I kind of paused when I get to Marvel, because there's this huge cinematic universe that is obviously out there. Thunderbolts has an asterisk at the end of it. Does that mean something?
Well, it seems to be an in-joke. I mean, I have to say, I always hope that my...
Never heard of them is the idea, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, it's standing in for something that they're going to be called,
yes,
I think.
Yes, which we gave away at the end of the
Yeah, which yeah. is going to it's going to have yeah. a proper name. But I'm always hoping that my co-reviewer is a fan, because I'm not.
Sorry to let you down.
Oh, no.
But never, like, even if you weren't a fan, do you need to know everything about the Marvel Cinematic Universe
you
to view one of the
actually.
Films?
No, you don't, because they're so simplistic, you don't. But on the other hand, I think these are films for fans, because I think they assume that the fans will go to the next one, the next one, and the next one. And there is a certain, I think, kind of excitement about who'll be in it, what kind of character they'll be playing, and what the kind of plot clash will be. Because actually what happens, you know, you're never for a moment worried about the central characters, because you know that they will exercise their superhero powers. Yeah, and then that, you know, everybody who you don't like will probably get their comeuppance, and if not, well, actually it doesn't really matter, because, you know, how far from real is this? So, but I think they carry their fans with them, and I think the fans like to discuss this online.
Yeah, they do. They love all that. Although
to discuss the film online, at length.
They do.
Oh yeah, there's a Reddit, you know, subreddits, you know, dedicated to this, and they'll go on.
This is relatively standalone, though, compared to a lot of Marvel films. There are a couple of carryovers. Obviously, the main character Yelena Belova is actually the sister of Black Widow, and she did appear in
the previous
film.
Florence Pugh, who, as far as I'm concerned, could kind of read the phone book on screen, and you'd probably watch her.
Yeah, she is. The camera loves her, and the shape of her face, the shape of her head. She's obviously a very good actor, as she proved years ago. She hasn't always made the best choices in recent times, but she does kind of carry this. She is this assassin, and she's an unhappy assassin. There are some jokes in this film, and at the start she's breaking into a lab and beating up security guards, and while she does, it's this sort of like Hamlet-like interior monologue in which she says she's not happy in her work and seems to be considering ending it all. And then we find out that she's been working for this dodgy CIA director, who's played by Julie Louis-Dreyfus, Valentina Allegra de Fontaine. She insists on the de Fontaine. She's dodgy. She's trying to clean up.
Yeah.
She's the Senate. She's in trouble with the Senate committee, which is very topical. And she's trying to clear up loose ends. And then Yelena finds out that she also is a loose end, that she's trying to get rid of her and a couple of other assassins as well.
All right. And I think it's from them that we're going to hear in this first clip.
Yeah.
Thunderbolts confront Valeria de, whatever the rest of the name is. I remember the death bit forever. Played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, as you said. And we'll hear the voices here of Sebastian Stan, the aforementioned Florence Pugh, and David Harbour.
Who sends today?
Congressman Barnes. Wow. You know, I never really thought you'd have a promising political career, but less than half a term. Yikes.
We're taking you in, Val.
I don't think so. Junior varsity, Captain America.
Walker.
Oh, nice to see you, Ava. Yelena, you look awful. Mm-hmm. You sure you're really ready for that public-facing role you asked me about?
Eat shit, Valentina. Where's Bob?
Look at you. You are all so adorable. Just think, I send you down there to kill each other, and instead, you make nice and you form a team. Who is this old Santa?
I'm Alexei Shostakov. The Red Guardian.
What?
There we had Florence Pugh, Valeria De Fontaine.
Yeah, very good, yeah.
Played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and also the voices of Sebastian and David Harbour.
And David Harbour, we should explain, is her dad, Yelena's dad, and he's this sort of vodka-swilling sort of failed superhero who is nostalgic about the Soviet
age. And they're all
age,
using quite dodgy Eastern European, well, certainly Florence
they are,
and
but the thing is, for me, you get used, David Harbour's kind of doing a bit samey, but you get used to hers, and you just, because she's so good, you accept whatever she's doing.
We're talking about superhero movies, but I guess PhD in this one, Ruth, these are not superheroes. These are super anti-heroes.
This is actually a crucial point that you're making, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're all so sad and so failed that they've been labelled anti-heroes. Now, actually, I thought PhD wise an anti-hero was something completely different, but they are self-identifying. Yeah. They are identifying.
And self-loathing. As
and
well.
Self-loathing. Yeah. And they've got, I mean, they're having quite a lot of fun with kind of Gen Z self-indulgent sadness, you know.
And I guess it's important that we remember that it's very easy to be snotty about the Marvel Cinematic Universe and all of that, but in fact, they are incredibly popular, and people do love. Are they? Is it entertaining on a funny level, on a thriller level, on an effects level?
Not for me, but I think if you are a fan, probably you'll go to this one, and I think it's probably, you know, you're going to have a good time. I think that there's nothing wrong with it, which is kind of damning with faint praise. But I think it does all the things you'd expect from a Marvel
It should be said, some of the Marvel films were very high quality. And very well made, like the first Captain America film and one of the Avengers films and a couple of others, some of the Thor films. Like, when they're done, they're very well done, they're very slick. This one, at least, is attempting something a little different. It has a sense of humour. And some of the special effects are very good indeed.
Yeah, the vaporizing is good.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, special effects, a bit of humour, that's
vaporized
fair,
me, yeah.
Fair enough. Stars from you on this one, Paul?
Because of special effects, the little black smudges and Florence Pugh, I give it 3 stars.
3. And Ruth?
Yeah, I think, you know, I felt at home with it. 3.
3 as well. Let us move on then to Parthenope, sunny Italy. Paolo Sorrentino brings us there. Who is this woman, Parthenope? And she's more than her name even suggests, or she is exactly what her name suggests. You can elucidate on that.
Yeah, she's born in 1950. She's actually born in a cove in a plush suburb of Napoli and into the warm Mediterranean. And she seems like a symbol from the start. And she's named by her wealthy godfather after, you know, the Greek name for the city. And she grows up, she's played as an adult by Celeste Dalla Porta, and she grows up into this very clever and self-possessed and beautiful. She's so beautiful that people stare after her in the street. She goes swimming and she turns around and all the men on the beach are staring at her. Unfortunately, her older brother is also obsessed with her, which is rather tragic for him. But she, in fairness to her, is determined not to be defined by that if possible.
Yeah.
She wants to be an independent person at a time, then an independent woman at a time that was not easy, especially in Italy. She flirts with acting to begin with, not successfully, and then she decides to study sociology and becomes a sociology professor. But all the time, what she looks like is a sort of barrier to her progress.
Yeah, so no matter what she has, qualifications she has, the men
people
in
just
the film,
want to
just
look
they
at
see,
her.
They see what she looks like rather than who she is.
Yes.
That's a reasonably good topic for somebody to take on, I would have thought, Ruth.
Yeah, I mean, here we're back to the PhD, my PhD issues, because she decides, will I be an actress or will I be an academic? And in the end, as you say, the actress thing doesn't really come to anything. So she decides to be an academic. She rocks up to her professor. She says, but what is anthropology? And he knows she's a genius on the spot. And thereafter...
You're suggesting that that doesn't really work like that.
Well, I wish...
Academia.
Well, I mean, actually, I don't have her looks, and maybe, but I hate to say it, but Third Level in Ireland, just it doesn't... No, I think not. Yeah. And then she does nothing. Like, she... I mean, there isn't much plot to this
story. I was going to say, does she do nothing because she's given very little to than look beautiful?
She just is there to look beautiful.
She's actually quite good in it, I think.
Oh, she's beautiful. She's beautiful.
And incredibly photogenic from all angles at all stages in her career. But there's nothing underneath her character. I don't think it's there. And
yeah, she does look enigmatic from time to time, you know. Or slightly quizzical. And they also tell us that she's got this absolutely devastating sense of humour. But unless it got lost in translation, I was not rolling in the aisles at her witty riposte.
No, Sorrentino has made some great films, like The Great Beauty is probably one of the best films of the last 20 years, and Hand of God, his film from 4 years ago, was this very personal story, autobiographical, about Naples, and it's much better. He makes the city look beautiful, much more beautiful than it actually is. I love Napoli, but it doesn't look like this when you go there. But I just think there are parts that are beautiful to watch, and there are some interesting actors. But his tendency towards visual lyricism in the best films are underpinned by performances from big actors like Tony Servillo, who he collaborates with all the time. And that just isn't there here, I don't think.
He has Gary Oldman, though.
He does.
In a cameo, and he's very enjoyable. He plays the real-life John Cheever, the writer, because, of course, she just loves John Cheever.
Whose alcoholism is left in no doubt. There's bottles everywhere.
Yeah. No doubt at all. And he's a kind of, he's a sad Englishman abroad kind of type. He's kind of a Death in Venice type of character. But we know that she's going to be very attracted to him because we see her reading a John Cheever book before she meets him. And this is, of course, because she is actually a hidden intellectual.
But sadly, she's barking up the wrong tree there, isn't she?
Oh, he leaves her no doubt.
And obviously, Celeste Delaporte, as you say, fills
gorgeous.
The screen and very
stunning.
Easy to watch.
She's stunning.
What about the rest of the men and women that we see, and in particular Naples itself? Not a bad looking city.
Oh no, there are some really beautiful scenes. He's great at finding these locations, these big churches, and there are some interesting other performances. I mean, I think Gary Oldman. He tends to be always good, doesn't
he?
And he is good in this.
Yeah.
And he leaves you wondering about John Cheever, actually, which is an interesting trick, given we only get 10 minutes of him. I thought that I don't have his... The professor was very good.
Silvio Orlando.
Yeah, her professor. He's this very kind of... He's known for his grumpiness, and people say it's because he has a child with health problems. But he's actually very good in it. He again draws you into his character
and doesn't give you
too much. Yeah.
So it kind of sounds like a bit of a curate's egg, this one.
Yeah, I mean, the trouble is you are so much... is reliant on us being absorbed by her beauty. And if you take that out of it, which you can't, but there's so little else. And although you have these sort of, as you say, these sort of pop-up characters, and again, there's this really sort of really creepy sort of Berlusconi-type looking bishop who...
He's a cardinal, actually.
Not that you'd know it. Well, he performs interesting sex acts on her, let's say, having dressed her in rather peculiar ecclesiastical sort of garb, including quite a lot of chains and whatnot. But they're all like, they're cameos. Each one pops into the story and out again. So you're never really getting a kind of narrative.
You're not fully engaged. Okay, stars from you on this one, Ruth?
Yeah, I gave it 3 because she was stunning, but I find it, I mean... I like a little bit of pretentiousness in my movies, but this one, too much.
It was actually actively so, and sort of less than some of his parts. I gave it 2.5, just to use a half star show.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the same if you didn't.
No.
Okay, that is Parthenope, the Paolo Sorrentino film that we've just been talking about. Let's move on to Sarah Scherer's new documentary feature, The Graceless Age. Which is about, the subtitle is The Ballad of John Murray, telling us his story. Just remind us of John Murray and his music and the nature of the character here, Ruth.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. I mean, I have to say, hands up, I hadn't heard of him. But you'd really want to go back now and listen to his music after hearing the really absorbing documentary. So John Murray was living in Ireland at the time that the film starts. So I think he subsequently moved back to the States. He's from Mississippi. He was adopted into a family who are the direct descendants of the writer William Faulkner. And he becomes so much part of that family in many ways, and particularly because of his addictive behaviour, which it turns out he shares with Faulkner, that his grandmother, Murray, adoptive grandmother, if you like, says, you're really like William Faulkner, and I don't mean that in a good way.
And he's not.
But he's no blood relatives. No. Yeah. He actually comes from a Native American family. He was adopted before,
to some extent,
he was born.
Yeah, Cherokee, I think.
Yeah, and that's right. And so he has this, you know, complex background. He has a proclivity towards addiction. He does have, you know, by all accounts, you know, a happy childhood, but then the addiction lands him into this institution. Things go very badly wrong for him there, and he spends a lot of his life subsequent to that, including getting married and having a child, fighting addiction and expressing it through his songs.
Let's have a listen to how he speaks, which has that wonderful
southern
language drawl. And there's a beautiful openness and fragility, I think, in everything he says, almost.
I grew up in Mississippi. I often felt like an outsider there. When I made my first album, The Graceless Age, I wanted to exercise everything that I couldn't tolerate within. Life hasn't followed the path that I thought I had charted out for it.
We knew we had a John problem.
And I made a mess of everything.
He goes back. There we go. That is the voice of John Murray in the documentary The Graceless Age, The Ballad of John Murray. I was just saying to you as we were listening there, I watched this, I think, quite a while back when it was on the festival circuit.
Yeah.
He goes back to his childhood, the various places, including the reservation, or certainly the area in which his
Native
American...
Well, he goes back to Tupelo, which another rather more famous singer comes from there in Mississippi, Elvis Presley, but he goes back there. And he meets, there's a few touching scenes. He meets this mentor, this great woman who is a church organist and music and inspired his love of church music, like Elvis actually, and also his daughter, which is kind of a sort of touchingly awkward encounter because he has obviously hasn't been in her life that much because he's been in Ireland and because of his other issues. As you say, he is painfully honest.
Yeah.
And when the time comes, he lets us have it in terms of what happened to him in his teenage years. But I actually, like Ruth was saying, I actually did, I had heard of him a little bit, but didn't know much, and started listening to the music afterwards. There's great sort of depth in it.
And my memory is that when he does, and it's incredibly open, and he doesn't hide anything that happened to him, horrific things, but there's a way in which he does that from my memory that seems to be about the people watching. It allows you as the watcher to really take on board what he says rather than him being angry and just shouting at the screen.
Yeah, I mean, he says, you know, he is, as you say, he's so thin skinned, you know, he feels everything, but he tells you, I'm telling you this so that other people can share their stories and feel they can share their stories. And so he's giving people a kind of template and also through his singing a way of expressing the things that have happened to them. And he's very generous. He's very generous with his stories. And I'm sure that you feel there was a very good relationship between him and Sarah Scher, the director.
Yeah, and Sarah Scher, of course, Paul had given us the documentary about Shane McGowan, If I Should Fall from Grace.
Yeah.
And similarly, she seems to have that facility to allow an artist who sometimes might be hard to fully understand what they're doing and why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Allow them to tell us.
Yeah, and that must involve establishing trust and then standing back at the right moments. And I mean, this is a little bit slow moving, this documentary, but I think probably that was the only way to do it. And the only person to tell his story was him.
Yeah.
And the good news is that he seems to be, we see him in Drumlish, in, you know, busking and doing gigs in the pubs, and he seems to have found a kind of home there, and he's writing music all the time.
Yeah.
So that's the good news, really.
Worth a view, then, it would suggest.
Yeah, I think so, especially if you've any interest. But 3.5 from me, Sean.
The Graceless Age, The Ballad of John Murray. And from you, Ruth?
I gave it 4. I got really lost in it. I really got absorbed by it. I thought it was very moving.
And it does send you off to the music. Which
it does. It really does. Some kind of Nick Cave-ish kind of sound.
That's really where he exposes himself hugely, in fact, in the music. Let's move on then this evening to Amongst the Wolves from Mark O'Connor. We're dealing with a character called Danny here. We're in a fairly familiar Dublin milieu, I think, Paul.
Yeah, well, Mark O'Connor has kind of come to, he's cornered the market in sort of low budget Dublin crime. There's that kind of B pictures and they're made for not much, which one always admires that he gets them made. King of the Travellers and Cardboard Gangster is probably the most celebrated of them. And yeah, they're films that make Tourism Ireland's job that little bit more difficult. And in this one, it's grim. Danny is, we don't find out too much. I mean, he does have this monologue about what happened. We don't find out too much or even enough about him, actually, to be honest. But he was a soldier. I presume he fought for the British because he was in Iraq. He's come back. He had a partner and they had a child and all is good. But this accident, which I think we can say because it happens early in the film, basically he was half asleep and dropped a cigarette in the house and. Yeah. The all trust has been lost between him and the partner as a consequence.
Jordan playing the partner and Luke McQuillan, who co-writes here, in fact, as well. Ruth.
He plays Danny, the central character. He's very good. He's got a very charismatic presence.
And he's now homeless, just to explain. And there seems to be no hope of redemption, but there might be.
And who is the character of Will then, this teenager that he meets? What kind of bond, what kind of relationship do you see growing between the Luke McQuillan character called Danny and the younger teenage character called Will, played by Daniel Fee?
Well, perhaps not surprisingly, Will becomes the son that he's lost, if you like. So he's lost his son Tig, essentially, to, you know, his wife, for very good reason, really. I mean, you'd be quite sympathetic to his wife. He's been irresponsible and continues to be irresponsible throughout the film. So he becomes like Ersatz father then to Will, who is a very kind of hapless, hopeless teenager who has a drug debt. He owes the gang leader, who's played by Aidan Gillen, very reliably. Yeah. He's played a few of these gang leaders before.
Power, his character's called.
Power is, yeah. And so he's terrified of them because the drug debt he's actually inherited from his father. There's no way he can pay it back.
Yeah,
so he's always in fear of them coming after him.
Let's listen to a clip that features Daniel Fee as Will in a car with Aidan Gillen as Power. I would not want to be sitting in a car with Aidan Gillen. Not with any of the characters he plays. Yeah. Let's have a listen to the two of them.
What are we doing here?
You said you wanted to go home. Is that your dog?
Yeah.
Is that a Dachshund?
Yeah.
I had a dog. Sparky. Lovely little fella. Did everything for him. Walked him. Fed him the best of meat. Steak. Mince. You name it. I had this problem with him. Every time I'd come off the leash, he'd run away. Did everything I could to keep him from running off. So I came to the conclusion that he was not to be trusted.
There you go. Aidan Gillen and Daniel
Fee. Doesn't end well for Sparky.
Poor old Sparky the dog, I don't think, had it come out of it well.
Dogs overall don't have a happy life in this film.
Yeah.
It's not a film for dog lovers.
How tense a world are we in? Because there is the family drama and then the fallout for the Luke McQuillan character, Danny. There is that aspect to it. Do we find ourselves in essentially a drug-fueled story?
Yeah, I found it was a film of kind of very much two parts. So one was essentially the melodrama, which was him trying to get his child back and going through the courts and dealing with his wife.
And was that played slightly melodramatically?
Well, it has all the kind of... It has all the components of it, because it's all about family and it's not about violence or anything. And it's not even because he's been violent in his past life, not at all. It's because he made this, fell asleep. Yeah, he was careless with a cigarette and with horrible consequences. And then the film rushes to a kind of generic gangster conclusion where he must save Will. And I won't go into too much detail, but suddenly he has to pull on all that he's learnt as a soldier in order to exercise this incredibly violent end. And there's an incredibly violent ending, an extended torture sequence, which is really nasty. So it seemed to me that the film is two parts are rubbing against each other, not entirely melding in what he's doing.
And what in terms of the performances, Paul?
I, as we said at the start, Luke McQuillan's actually good because he's underplaying this and he's not... He's not attempting to manipulate the viewer. He's good in it, very solid in it. And as you said, Aidan Gillen has played about 15 characters like that before, and he knows what he's doing. And all he does is the odd sneer to let us know that he's, and the dog story to let us know that he's not a pleasant fellow. But his presence is quite powerful. But I just didn't feel there was much underneath in terms of the characters, to be honest.
Stars from you on this one, Paul?
Two.
And Ruth?
I gave it three, but I mean, I thought at the time it was kind of a generous three. I just wish he'd make something else. He seems to be making the same film over and over again. Mark O'Connor. I'd love to see him stretch himself a little bit more and just go into slightly different territory and do something fresh.
All right, that's Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington. And this films they have been speaking to us about, Thunderbolts, asterisk for the Marvel fans, is in cinemas now. Amongst the Wolves goes on general release tomorrow. Parthenope and The Graceless Age, The Ballad of John Murray, will be in selected cinemas also from tomorrow. Lismore Castle in County Waterford plays host to Benjamin Britten's opera A Midsummer Night's Dream later this month as part of this year's Blackwater Valley Opera Festival. The production will be directed by Patrick Mason and will feature the Irish Chamber Orchestra conducted by David Brophy. I meant to check with you. What is the name of the man who plays Oberon? Yston.
Yes.
Yston Morris is Oberon. Amy Hewitt is Titania, the warring fairy king, and at the heart of the whole comedy. And Gemma Devrien is the Amazon queen, Hippolyta, who's quite haughty and in a big hurry to get on with her marriage when she'd been made watch a play. Yeah. Delighted that Gemma is here with me in studio this evening, as is David Brophy. And you can watch us, as I say, on rt.ie/arena. I mean, obviously, it's a Benjamin Britten opera, but it's a William Shakespeare play. How familiar is Benjamin Britten's Forest and Midsummer Night's Dream? If you're familiar with the Shakespearean play, David,
he kind of ignores Act One.
Which is the
backstory.
And the four young lovers are banished.
Yeah, so that's ignored. So we get straight into the into the action and the elves and the forest or the wood straight away. But beyond that, all the words are actually Shakespeare's, apart from one or two lines. The libretto was constructed by Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears themselves. I would say it's very faithful. So that Shakespearean English that we all struggled with in school is still there, but it works. And he writes in a way, I think the music's written in a way that, like, there's a harpsichord in the pit. There's something almost Elizabethan about, about the sound world that he creates in the orchestra itself.
And are those Shakespearean words easier to sing perhaps than they are to deliver in spoken form? Maybe you've never done that, Gemma.
I've never acted, just using my speaking voice, so I actually hadn't thought about it like that, but luckily, it's nice to be able to sing in English. It's kind of a rare occurrence sometimes in the world of opera, or if you do like a translation of an Italian or French opera, sometimes it's not always the greatest translation. To get to speak something that's native English is lovely. As Dave was saying, like, the comedy in it is hilarious. Like, yesterday we had a full music rehearsal and, like, we're just laughing the entire time. And, like, it was written, 450 years ago? And it's still funny today.
Well, you're in slap bang in the middle of perhaps the funniest section of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is when, as they're often referred to, the rude mechanicals, who are local tradesmen, I think, in the Shakespeare, the plumber, and they all come out and they perform a play for your character, Hippolyta, and isn't it
Theseus? Theseus, yes.
That she's getting married to, and she's like, why are we at this play? Yeah. Which is pretty awful, but it's awful in a very funny type of way.
Yeah. One of my favourite lines is they're saying, one of the female characters being played by a man is coming back. And I say, I hope she will be brief. It's just a tiny little line, but I just love it. That I think we've all been maybe to a play and a new character comes out and you're like, oh, Jesus, here we go.
Is this ever going to finish?
Yeah, exactly.
You don't need somebody new in there.
No.
But it is, as a result, really, because it is those Shakespearean words. Yes, of course, there are speeches, but they did cut things down. And a lot of it is like regular dialogue in that respect, in the fact, Anthony, that they're just talking, singing to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think the drama itself is very, very tight, the way Benjamin Britten has written the opera itself. So there's no, if you go to see, I saw that... Verdi's Don Carlos was on in Paris recently, and if you get the five act version with the Fontainebleau first act, it's like there's not much change out of 4 hours, you know. So we're not on that, like there's three acts, and each of the acts are between 45 and 50 minutes long, you know. So it's very tightly staged in that way and set that way. But you're right, he'd like Britain does follow the text very closely and the rhythms of the text as well. And I know we were talking, we had rehearsal earlier on and we were trying to deal with hast doth, which is very difficult actually to sing because you're looking for vowels to sing on. So the S and the T and the D and the TH it's at the end, they're kind of tricky. So the words at times are tricky, but Britain always writes in a way that suits all the vocals. So it's not too difficult.
I think I just rechristened you David. I called you Anthony.
I would
another
take Anthony
Brophy.
As long as you're looking at me, I'll
know
exactly what's going on.
David Brophy who's sitting in front of me. Let's have a listen to, in fact I was going to just come straight in on the at the beginning of the piece. There's a lovely chorus, but I want to kind of make my way into it. You could possibly put on the headphones if you have them there beside you, if you want, if you have one there, because I want you to get, we can talk over this a little bit, because it's the kind of atmosphere that it creates. David,
yeah,
you can hear just that rumble, and it's really quiet.
So you hear those chords and it's just in the lower strings and straight away it feels like it's dark. And you've got these sliding lines we call glissando. And, you know, if you can visualize a string player, you're playing double bass, and you run your string, your finger along the length of the string.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the wood around, well, Athens, but Lismore in our case, is breathing. You listen.
Kind of scary in some ways.
It's frightening as well, but otherworldly, and something comforting about it. It's gentle as well. It's like, in terms of an opening to an opera, we normally have an overture.
Yeah,
I think opera. This is how it begins.
And it demands then that you kind of shut up and listen.
Well, you know, the overture would have, like, traditionally, centuries back, would have been designed to keep everybody quiet. They've just come in from the bar, let's assume that, you know, like, but this is not the opening like that. It starts so soft. And you can, it should be so soft, you can hear everyone breathing behind you in the audience. And then it starts, normally it doesn't start, an opera would not start with a chorus. This does start with a chorus.
And just before I get to that, because that kind of sound world, I think, is quite typical of what Britain does throughout the opera to create atmosphere.
Well, it's one of the number of operas that Britain wrote that has not a huge orchestra. I went to see Tristan and Isolde recently in Cologne, and they have it's a huge, magnificent, ginormous orchestra, you know, like,
well, it's Wagner, you know, so it has to be big.
It has to be huge, and you kind of feel this is a completely different, it's a more transparent world. And if you think like the fairies and the spirits that are such a central part of this opera are somewhere in the air, all this electricity in the sky that's around us, the things that we say, oh, that's kind of strange how that works, the magic of Puck and the fairies, that's all kind of, it permeates all the orchestrations.
And let's have a listen to then, when that kind of atmospheric section goes on for about a couple of minutes, but then the bells start to ring and we hear different voices. And obviously, David, that's David Brophy with me in studio this evening, along with Gemini Vrain, who are both part of the Blackwater Valley Opera Festival and their upcoming production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And even though you have a snare drum and a trumpet in there, it still has this feeling of a very intimate kind of telling of the story.
I think that this genius. Like the orchestration, we heard the beginning, the opening, the strings, the celli and the basses, but then that brightness is actually one harpsichord, two harps, glockenspiel and triangle. And this kind of almost like you kind of feel, God, I'm back in school with the triangle and, you know, the little glockenspiel, you know, like the little bells we had. I'm back in school. And I think part of one of the themes is that innocence, that purity in children's voices.
And of course, voices. Do you have a boys' chorus or a children's chorus?
It's a children's chorus, not just boys. It's, in fact, it's primarily girls. And they are Piccolo Lasso. The Fantastic. Yes. So we had rehearsed with them during the week, and they're fantastic. They don't know what's going on yet, but they will. And the magic, the magic is in them at the beginning. So what a way to start an opera.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And so when you come to a production of any opera, Gemma, I suppose one of the things that you have to decide, and it's Patrick Mason who's directing here, you have to decide, where are we setting this, and what world am I going to put these people into? So what world has he chosen to put you and your would-be husband, the king, and all of these lowly serfs who are all around you doing this play?
Surrounded by peasants. Patrick, so I hadn't worked with Patrick before, but I'd heard great things about him. And so yesterday we got the presentation of the concept and the design. And he had done so much like historical research into it. And it's really, you know, sometimes you think Shakespeare is, you know, very English, maybe very removed.
Yeah.
So our production, back to your original question, is being set in kind of 1950s Ireland, but with kind of throwbacks to Elizabethan references with a costume. But Patrick was saying that the year that Shakespeare wrote this play, 1595. Was the same year that the Earl of Desmond, who lived in Lismore Castle, was kicked out. And then the castle itself was then bought by Sir Walter Raleigh. So it's kind of just this weird connection between Shakespeare
and
Lismore.
You're in that Shakespearean world, but we're quite definitely in 1950s Ireland.
I won't say definitely, but I think he was saying that the serfs and the servants and the actors, they will be the kind of creating this. They'll be set in 1950s. And then when we get into the show, and especially with the fairies and stuff, there will be this kind of otherworldly, ethereal, fairyland dream quality to them, but there will be references back to Elizabethan as well. We're still very early in the staging process. Today was day one. So I can't say for certain exactly what it's going to look like. And I don't want to give any major spoilers. But it's going to develop. And like Patrick talking yesterday about the concept, it was so clear in his mind he wants.
And there are a number of actors involved, not least of whom is Barry McGovern. He's playing...
He's playing the part of Puck.
Puck, who's the mischievous sprite.
And actually, Patrick mentioned yesterday in the presentation that Puck, its word and its use in the English language potentially came from Ireland and Puka.
Yeah.
Which makes total sense. And we have got Puck Fairs, which is a very Irish thing as well, you know. So to have Barry there was fantastic. And Barry actually sings a little bit.
Yes.
So he has a little bit later on
there are operas with speaking parts, and more recently in contemporary operas that is happening a lot more, where you have spoken roles within contemporary opera. Mozart did it, but Britain was a bit ahead of his time in terms of this, in terms of an English language opera, perhaps.
Yeah, well, obviously spoken role is a new thing, but to have a lead in Oberon.
Yeah, it's not just a chorus.
Who's a counter tenor written for Alfred Deller. That was an unusual thing. I think that's where I don't think the use of an actor and a spoken voice is so revolutionary. That's in lots of other operas as well. But I do think a lead role, like how many, you know, countertenors do you have in a 20th century opera? Take a lead role, and Oberon is the lead role, is one of the lead roles in this, and it's a very important person. So and I think as Gemma said, that otherworldliness comes from that voice. You hear the countertenor comes in, you go, this sounds otherworldly too. It's all about transporting you somewhere where you have never been before.
It's a Midsummer
Night's Dream.
You don't
know where you are. It's a dream. And the difference between the dream and what's reality and not what isn't reality is a very central part of what we're doing.
And as well as that historical reference that you gave us, Gemma, about Lismore Castle, there's just simply an atmosphere about an opera in the grounds of a castle, which will add huge amounts to this production, I would have thought. It adds it to all the productions that happen there, obviously, but in a particular way to this.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really magical. This is my second time doing Lismore now, but my first time was we did Janiskeke, and it was their first production post-COVID. So it was still in that kind of restriction phase, less audience, you know, had to be under an hour. And I loved my time in that first time. But this, I feel, is kind of like my true full Lismore experience. And the fact that we get to do a full kind of 3-hour opera during a Midsummer Night. It's just really going to add to it. And I think it's you know, when Patrick was saying about just the connection to Lismore Castle itself, and this is Lismore's 20th anniversary year, it's almost kind of a perfect match.
And to think that you could have been off somewhere studying applied science or teaching applied science if you'd followed your initial career path. You kind applied of bumped science, into opera.
Really? I really didn't know much about opera before before ending up at the Royal Irish Academy of Music.
And Veronica Dunn was one of your teachers.
Ronnie was my teacher. I was very lucky to have her as my teacher. But yeah, I kind of went going through school, like I did singing lessons, I did music lessons and stuff. And yeah, my big interests were either music or science. But it's funny, I know a lot of people were musicians where science would have been an interest in theirs. There's a link there somewhere in the brain.
Music was one of the sciences in the 18th century.
Well, I would say music is an applied science in some ways. It's aural mathematics, I've always referred to it.
Very good. Aural mathematics,
That one is for nothing.
We take that, Sean. Thanks.
Sisters, listen, thanks to both of you.
Pleasure.
For coming in. Best of luck with it all. It sounds very exciting indeed.
Thanks, Sean.
David Brophy and Gemma Vrain there talking to us about Blackwater Valley Opera Festival. It runs from the 27th of May through to the 2nd of June. That's the next bank holiday weekend, this one that's coming up right now. And you can get full details on blackwatervalleyopera.ie. Let us move on to the bond between two trailblazing Irish artists, Mainey Jellett and Evie Hone. It celebrated this particular friendship in a major exhibition at the National Gallery of Ireland. The exhibition is open right now. It will run through the summer until the 10th of August, in fact. The show is called, suitably enough, Mainey Jellett and Evie Hone, The Art of Friendship. It comprises 90 of their works, takes us through their careers, their friendship, their similarities and their differences. Jess Fahey has been to the National Gallery of Ireland. She's with me in studio this evening. And I should say, we will be posting some of the images of the works that we'll be discussing on our X handle. I think it's up on Instagram as well, but certainly on the X handle. Let's talk about these two women and the Ireland in which they were trying desperately, succeeding extraordinarily to be artists who were taken seriously.
Yeah, so I think that's the thing that I've always found most inspirational about them is that they managed to do so much when they were up against it. So if we think about the Ireland, as you say, that they were working as artists in, women weren't really considered professionals and they were often sort of sidelined, not given the same sort of consideration.
We're talking about essentially, I suppose, they were active as artists in
1920s, 30s, 40s. Yeah. So particularly when they were starting off, it would have been, you know, unheard of even for a woman to have a full academician position in the RHA. Sarah Purser being the first to do that towards the end of the 1920s. So there was a sort of dismissal of them in that regard. Then they were also from Protestant families in a new free state, Ireland. So they were going against the current there as well. But possibly the worst crime they had was that they were modernists.
I was going to say, never mind all of those obstacles. They then had to persuade the Irish art-loving public that modernism was something that had to be taken into account, which Joyce had done in terms of literature. How big a battle did they have fighting? Sometimes when you hear people that I would have considered erudite, open, artistically, looking for new experiences, and they're just closed down. No, this modernism rubbish, get rid of it.
Absolutely. And it was very much the stance of all the art institutions as well as some of the main critics. So just to give an example, when Jellett first exhibited two abstract pieces in 1923, the response was to call them subhuman freak paintings. The suggestion from A.E. George Russell was that she was sick in some way, that she was suffering from this form of what he called an artistic malaria. So all of this was the response they got. And the next year in 24, Hone and Jellett exhibit together. And it's only for a few outlining voices, people like Maud Ball, for example, who was an artist and writer who recognised what they were doing. But if we put it into sort of broader context, if you look at, you know, what's happening even, say, in Paris at this time, which is where both of them had studied under Cubist and under a sort of Cubist abstract artist, even there, abstract art wasn't yet sort of taken on or accepted. Yeah. You kind of have to sort of wait almost to the 1950s with abstract expressionism for it to be
very
accepted.
Easy for us in 2025 to look at it and say, well, what was their problem? Because we have been taught how to understand it now, and maybe in a way that the language wasn't there to explain it or to open it up to people at the time. When did Evie Hone and Mainey Jellett actually meet and start to become this powerhouse, this duo, this artistic duo who seemed to just not only support each other, but support anybody around them who was trying to do something different?
Yeah, I mean, they were so supportive of the whole of the, you know, art world in Ireland, and particularly younger artists coming up. But they met, we believe, in around 1917. Both of them, although they were born in Dublin, doesn't seem they met until they were studying the Westminster School under Walter Sickert. And from that time onwards, they seem to have worked quite closely together as students, both ending up in Paris, as first studying with André Lahoud, then Albert Glaze, who Jack B. Yeats famously said, "Who the blazes is Glazes," because everyone seemed to be talking about him all the time.
He wasn't very keen to find out, it has to be said.
No, that's true. And there was sort of that sort of sense that these silly women are going off to study with these odd artists. And there was a dismissal even of the people who study with Lahoud, calling them Lahoud's wives, suggesting maybe that, you know, something a bit nefarious was going on. But in actual fact, these women just wanted the newest ideas. They wanted to be the most experimental. And if you think of an art institution that had kept them out for so long, it makes more sense that women gravitated towards new ideas and, you know, brave new sort of adventures in art, as the story in Irish art is almost all our modernists, particularly in the beginning, were women, which is really fascinating.
I suppose we think of Mainey Jellett predominantly as a painter. We think of Evie Hone is predominantly as a maker of stained glass windows. If we talk about, and these images will be available on our X handle at RTE Arena, decoration, which is perhaps, some would argue, the most important modernist Irish painting. Yeah. Irish modernist painting.
Absolutely. And it's only in the collection because Evie Hone donated it, which is an important thing to point out, because the collection of, you know, buying works by these women didn't really happen. Even as late as the 90s, early 2000s, I remember talking to Bruce Arnold, who said you could pick them up for, you know, a couple of quid here and there. But thankfully now they're getting this sort of resurgence. But with decoration, what's fascinating is that although it's abstract, so it's a mixture of sort of colours and shapes that look like they've been sort of spun around a central axis, it's actually referring in a kind of more direct way, not just to modernism, but to medieval art. So the shape of it, which is a sort of pointed shape, as well as the fact that the board and the frame are all one, it's painted in tempera and gold. So it actually looks more like a kind of early Renaissance altarpiece, but without the figurative elements. But when you look at the shapes and when you compare it and consider it in that context, you start to realise that it looks like the Virgin and Child.
Yeah, and the minute that said to you, the minute I read that, it was all I could see. I couldn't see beyond it. And in some ways, they deserve to be viewed purely in terms of their composition as much as anything else.
I think there's something really intriguing in it, though, because the earliest abstract artists were looking for a universal language that would appeal to everybody. So they were trying not to be elitist. And if you think about a Christian image in an Irish context at this time, when there's such a divide between Catholic and Protestant, picking something that seems more open, more universal, actually is really appropriate, I think.
Yeah, and in some ways a radical move to do at the time. And in terms of Evie Hone, then, how much of the stained glass do we get to see? Or are we seeing reproductions of the stained glass? I suppose the big Eton commission is the one that you'd love to see.
Yeah, the East Window in Eton. One of the most extraordinary things that she made, and along with...
And religious based. It's a religious...
And she did secular as well. So in the government buildings, they have the Four Green Fields as well, which is another one of hers. But they have preparatory studies, which relate to those bigger windows, and then they have some smaller pieces. So there is a dark room that shows you her actual stained glass, and that is a mixture of things that would either be individual ones that she worked up to show a patron as to what the finished work might be, or her just doing tests and trying to explore what she's going to create ultimately.
You mentioned there that decoration, it was bequeathed by Mainey Jellett to Evie Hone, and that in itself says something about the nature of the relationship between them. How would you define that relationship in both personal and artistic terms?
So in artistic terms, I think the fact that the two of them were there supporting each other when they were doing something so on the outside of what everyone else was doing, particularly in Ireland, is very significant. They both worked tirelessly to support other artists, as we've already mentioned, on committees, founding the Irish Exhibition of Living Art, And then from a personal perspective, they were very supportive of each other. So when Evie Hone in 1924, possibly after all those bad reviews, ends up going over to a convent in Cornwall, it's actually Mainey Jellett who sent over to bring her home by her sisters. And then when Mainey Jellett died very young in her late 40s of cancer, it was actually the night before she died that one of her last visitors was Evie Hone. So you can see how close they were throughout, both personally and professionally.
And just one other painting I want to mention is Mainey Jellett, The Virgin of Era.
It's a fantastic work, and it shows you something that she was doing which was so extraordinary. So she herself said that if a medieval artist from Ireland, pre-colonial artist, was to arrive in Dublin in the 1920s or 30s, they'd have more in common with modernists than they would with the academic realists like Keating and others. And if you look at this, even the way that the knees are sort of depicted looks almost identical to what you'd see in the Book of Kells, but the work itself seems extraordinarily modern. It's not completely abstract. These are forms, and you can see the Virgin in the middle, St. Patrick, and then St. Bridget on either side. So she managed to bring together a sort of very positive pre-colonial Irish artistic identity with a new modern voice, as well as one that kind of combines, I suppose, very serious theories around art too. So she does a multitude of things in this, and yet it took a while before the Irish government recognised this is perhaps a good type of visual art for a new Ireland.
It's not the first time that they have been in an exhibition together, and there's a lovely symmetry in this. It goes back, it's not quite a century, is it a little bit over
just
the century?
Just a little over. So 1924 was the year they exhibited together about 50 or so works, only on for a couple of weeks. And they never exhibited just the two of them together. They were in group shows together, including many in Paris, and in one funny occasion Evie Hone was included as one of the greater artists because they mistook her name to be a male name. So this happened quite often to women. If they could slip under the radar of being female, they got better responses. But in terms then of them having retrospective solo shows, all of that as well. But this is the first time to have the two together where you can really compare them, because in the early days, it's almost indistinguishable. It can be very hard to immediately tell which one's which. But generally speaking, Jellett is more precise, very sharp, very clean. She's much more interested, arguably, in the theory and the mathematics, whereas Evie Hone has a sort of looser, lighter touch in many ways.
And even though their artistic practice might have gone in slightly different directions, the friendship lasted right through. Is it possible to quantify how important these two women, Mainey Jellett and Evie Hone, are to Irish art?
I'm just so glad that they're finally being recognised. I mean, I've been teaching about them for years, so when I saw this exhibition coming up, I got incredibly excited. They're inspirational within the context of art history, but just also, I think, too, within the context of stick with what you believe in. And if you find a space for yourself or create a space for yourself, broaden it out to let other people in too, which was exactly the thing that the institutes in Ireland were not doing by rejecting modernists, by rejecting women. So the more you look at the history of Irish art, it wouldn't exist in the way that it does without these women. They were truly extraordinarily goal-orientated action people who got things done rather than just focused on their own artistic practice.
Well, thanks for opening up that world to us, Jess Fahey there. And Mainey Jellett and Evie Hone, The Art of Friendship, is open now, as I said, at the National Gallery. It runs through until the 10th of August. Information and tickets on ngi.ie. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Mark McGrath was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and produced by Sinead Egan. I will be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. And Ray Cudahy will be with you after the news.